I think you'll find that the statement in Latin, where charity and love is found, that's where God is actually a very radical statement when you hear the reading that you're going to hear this morning. Because the reading this morning from Harvey Cox suggests something entirely different. The first reading is excerpted in several parts from a much longer article published in Atlantic Monthly 15 years ago, that is before 9/11, before the severe economic downturn, call it what you will. Harvey Cox is the author, a theologian out of Harvard, and his famous book, The Secular City, back in the 60s, set all theology on its head. He's also quite famous for an article he published famously and in, of all places, Playboy magazine, about Jesus of Galilee, accompanied by an illustration of the teacher laughing his head off. He's a popularizer of theology. Nevertheless, he's a respected theologian of the modern era and has probably had more impact than most of his generation. I want you to know that complete copies of his article will be available in print outside for those who want afterward. A theological education is not a waste of time. This is absolutely an excellent, excellent, upsetting, wonderful article. And you can also look at it online as well. So this is going to be in several sections, and I'll ring a little bell in between because they're not connected.
In days of old, seers entered a trance state and then informed anxious seekers what kind of mood the gods were in, and whether this was an auspicious time to begin a journey, get married, or start a war. The prophets of Israel went to the desert and then returned to announce whether God was feeling benevolent or wrathful. Today, the market's fickle will is clarified by daily reports from Wall Street. Thus, we can learn on a day-to-day basis that the market is apprehensive, relieved, nervous, or even at times jubilant. On the basis of this revelation, awed adepts make critical decisions about whether to buy or sell. Like one of the devouring gods of old, the market, aptly embodied in a bull or a bear, must be fed and kept happy under all circumstances. True, at times its appetite may seem excessive, a $35 billion bailout here, a $50 billion one there, but the alternative not to bow to its hunger is too terrible to contemplate. The diviners and seers of the market's moods are the high priests of its mysteries. To act against them is to risk excommunication and possibly damnation. Today, for example, if the government policy vexes the market, those responsible for the irreverence will be made to suffer. That the market is not at all displeased by downsizing or a growing income gap should not cause anyone to question its ultimate omniscience.
One sometimes wonders, in this era of market religion, where the skeptics and the freethinkers have gone. What has happened to the Voltaires, who once exposed bogus miracles, and the H.L. Mencken's, who blew shrill whistles on pious humbuggery? Such is the grip of current orthodoxy that to question the omniscience, the all-knowingness of the market, is to question the inscrutable wisdom of providence itself. The metaphysical principle is obvious. If you say it's the real thing, then it must be the real thing.
It used to be thought, mistakenly as it turns out, that at least the innermost or spiritual dimension of life was resistant to the market. But as the markets for material goods become increasingly glutted, such previously unmarketable states of grace as serenity and tranquility are now appearing in the catalogs. Furthermore, ecstasy and spirituality are now offered in a convenient generic form. Thus, the market makes available the religious benefits without the awkwardness of denominational commitment. All can now handily be bought without an unrealistic demand on one's time. In a weekend workshop at a Caribbean resort with a sensitive psychological consultant replacing the crotchety retreat master.
On October 26th, 1996, the German government ran an ad offering the entire village of Liebenberg in what used to be East Germany, for sale, with no previous notice to its some 350 inhabitants. Liebenberg's citizens, many of them elderly or unemployed, stared at the notice in complete disbelief. They had certainly loathed communism, but when they opted for the market economy that reunification promised, they hardly expected this. Liebenberg includes a 13th century church, a Baroque castle, a lake, a hunting lodge, two restaurants, and 3,000 acres of meadow and forest. Overnight, Liebenberg became a living parable, providing an invaluable glimpse of the kingdom in which the market's will is indeed done. But the outraged burghers of the town did not feel particularly blessed. They complained loudly, and the sale was finally postponed. Everyone in town realized, however, that it was not really a victory. The market, like God, may lose a skirmish, but in a war of attrition, it will always win in the end. There was a time when people spoke, at least occasionally, of inherent worth. If not of things, then at least of persons. The Liebenberg principle changes all that. One wonders what would become of a modern Luther who tried to post his theses on the church door, only to find that the entire edifice has been bought by an American billionaire who reckoned it might look nicer on his estate. The second reading, much shorter, is from the great San Antonio poet whom I love, Naomi Shihab Nye. She's talking about a baby she watched in his crib, and the title, intriguingly, is "How Far Is It to the Land We Left?"
On the first day of his life, the baby opens his eyes and gets tired even doing that. He cries when they place a cap on his head. Too much, too much. Later, the whole world will touch him, and he won't even flinch.
Home. Home. Sounds a little bit like the famous religious syllable from the religions of India, Om, that many people have chanted or have heard chanted. I'll tell you this, home was something I was chanting like crazy last Tuesday. And I wasn't alone either. I was chanting home with a woman I didn't even know named Colleen from Bend, Oregon. Here's the story. I was coming back from the last leg of my sabbatical after 6 weeks away. I had been out in California the past 2 weeks and was returning through Phoenix. After spending some time with my friend Marco Antonio at the airport, he came out to have lunch with me there. I set off on the very last leg of my journey to Columbus. When we got over the Columbus airport, the snow was falling heavy. The rain, the sleet, whatever it was, we could see it zipping past our windows. And we circled the airport for about 45 minutes, after which the pilot said that we were going to have to go to Cleveland because he was running out of fuel. And that the storm had closed Port Columbus Airport for the rest of the night. So after a half an hour, we landed in a totally, and to me, surprisingly, snow-free Cleveland around midnight. And then we sat out on the tarmac for 3 full hours in the plane, listening to dutiful announcements every 15 minutes from the wonderful pilot, telling us what the authorities of Southwest Airlines in Dallas were deciding that we should do. Finally, at 3, they told us that the flight was canceled and that they would rebook us onto another flight to get us home. Of course, the airport in Cleveland was also closed, it being 3 o'clock in the morning. Nobody was there, so they woke up 2 very sleepy folks to attend to the needs of 188 passengers who had not slept, I assure you, in almost 24 hours by that time. As we stood in line for well over an hour, we overheard what the folks at the desk were saying to those lucky enough to be in the line ahead of us. "Well, we can get you home tomorrow afternoon through Baltimore, since there are no flights directly from Cleveland to Columbus on Southwest, or maybe through Nashville." People in my part of the line groaned in despair. So this woman I don't even know, Colleen, and I started to talk. And suddenly we got the idea that we should just drive home. We should rent a car and drive home. It would be quicker than going to Baltimore and back in the afternoon. And we knew that Southwest was not going to be paying for this or covering this expense. So we stayed awake until 6 when the rent-a-car place opened up. We got our luggage, took the jitney over to the center, rented a car at considerable expense because we were just dropping it off and not returning it, and then made our way to the airport here in Columbus where we were going to return the car. And the whole time, we spoke these ritual words to each other. As we made a reservation, we said, "The next step toward home." As we picked up our luggage, we said, "The next step toward home. The next step toward home, waiting for the rent-a-car place to open. The next step toward home, waiting for the jitney bus to arrive. The next step toward home, renting the car, finding the right credit card, finding the car in the cold lot, finding Highway 71. All the way to Columbus, Colleen and I kept on saying this sentence to each other, "The next step toward home." We said it when we saw the green Delaware sign on the freeway. We said it when we saw the sign for Morse Road. when we saw the airport, when we paid for the car, when we took the bus to the lot where I had left my car parking, and when I took her to her daughter's house at OSU, step after step after step, each time we said that most sacred word, home, home. And that word, I assure you, gave us strength, and it gave us focus, and it gave us hope. It was something we wanted more than anything else in that sleepy, sleepy state, weary beyond belief. Home, home, home. And finally, by noon on Wednesday, I arrived home to a bed just as comfortable as I had imagined, to nourishment in the refrigerator as delicious as I had remembered, to mail in the mailbox as hilariously pointless as it always is, and to cheery notes from friends who had stopped by to check on my place while I was gone. Home, home, home. I was so tired that I couldn't sleep when I got home, or maybe it was all the coffee I drank to keep from crashing the car while I was driving at 6 o'clock in the morning, but I was home. And I'm glad to say this morning that my journey home was a lot easier, because I wasn't alone. Colleen and I shared the cost. We shared the emotions of the event, which I assure you were considerable. We shared the driving. We shared the navigation. We shared countless stories of our lives and about our families and about what we loved and didn't love, liked and didn't like. We shared the rituals of mutual comfort, the repeated chant, one more step toward home. One more step toward home. Both Colleen and I were, I have to say, surprisingly patient and good-humored about it all. There would have been a time in my life when this kind of event would have upset me to the point of paralysis and maybe tears, like the baby in Naomi Shihab Nye's poem who starts to cry, "Too much, too much," when some silly adult puts a cap on its head. I've grown up, I guess, over the years, got myself more grounded. I'm not as easily knocked flat as I used to be. More on this poem at the end of the sermon, for there is still more to say. I'm sharing the story of my journey home with you this Sunday because it struck me as a very fitting and appropriate image for this congregation as we're planning and gathering our fiscal resources for the coming year. Some of you have already made pledges, and some of you are still hearing about it. You heard the announcement from Deb this morning. Some of you are just visiting here for the first time today. To you last folks especially, I say, don't worry. It's not that kind of talk. I do, however, want to bring up some of the observations of Harvey Cox, about the finances of the market, which you may find helpful, even if you just are stopping by the church shop today. 13 years ago, I gave a talk here titled A Hidden Diversity, where I spoke of the significant differences in our community, which have nothing at all to do with what we believe or don't believe religiously or spiritually, which has nothing at all to do with the shape of our faces, the colors of our skins, the ages of our bodies, the physiology of our genders. It has to do with the experiences and attitudes that we have toward the symbol we call money, especially in regard to religion and spirituality. I talked, for example, of my Roman Catholic background in the 1950s, where there were no such things as pledge campaigns and strict budgets just weekly offering baskets at the seven masses every Sunday in the single congregation, filled to overflowing by the 5,000 families that were members of the church. I spoke of my time faithfully attending a radical Jewish synagogue in San Francisco, where the rabbi and I had a conversation in her office in which she sat me down and told me what I was going to give for the budget of the synagogue in exact amounts. I told the story of visiting Ephesians Church of God in Christ, an African-American Pentecostal church in Oakland, California, famous across the country for its gospel music program. There, they kept on having offerings during the service over and over during the four-hour service until they got exactly the amount they needed to get by that week, which they named quite openly to the penny. And this only after the bishop gave a full half-hour offertory invitation with the emotional drama that reminded me of grand opera. I also spoke of people who had no religious upbringing whatsoever and had no idea that churches or synagogues or mosques or any spiritual organization even had budgets or strategic plans or capital campaigns or bank accounts even. Now, obviously, since that sermon 13 years ago, a whole lot has changed in our nation and also in my life. The generations have risen and fallen, as they always do, as usual. And now we are talking about Generation X and Generation Y and Generation Z, and we're talking a lot less about the baby boomers, except that they're all going to retire in about 5 minutes. And we're talking post 9/11, as I said, and we're talking after the economic downturn. We're talking joblessness and bailouts, contested elections, and hard-to-believe debates on the floors of Congress, which would have made many earlier generations clutch at their hearts in shock. And personally, I've actually continued my interest in all this. I visited other religious groups so I could learn about even more varieties of religious approaches to fiscal integrity. The local mosque I visited doesn't even have a membership list or a phone list or anything like that, and that idea is completely foreign to the imam there. He has no idea who goes in and out of the prayer rooms and doesn't understand why that's important or why anybody would want to know. When I asked him after hearing this how the undeniably beautiful new building in which we were standing as we were talking had been built, clearly the triumph of some very expensive architect, he answered, "Oh, we just put out the word that something needed to be done." Ah, just like that. And also, since that last sermon on fiscal diversity so long ago, a new religious approach to money, one that I find both distasteful and upsetting, has taken prominence in many of the larger and more pop American congregations. It's a little humbug called prosperity theology. Prosperity theology basically says Jesus wants you to be rich with 20,000 square foot mansions and garages full of Jaguars. If you are poor and struggling, it's because you're not giving enough to the church. If you give sacrificially, Jesus himself will send you checks in the mail and heal all of your illnesses. If you are stingy, you will stay poor and you will stay sick. And look, I am not making this up. I am not making this up. It sickens me that so many have bought into this nonsense. No wonder strong atheism and anti-religious fervor is growing in leaps and bounds. It needs to. Remember what Harvey Cox said in the reading? And this was 15 years ago. One sometimes wonders, in this era of market religion, where the skeptics and freethinkers have gone. What has happened to the Voltaires who once exposed bogus miracles, and the H.L. Mencken's who blew shrill whistles on pious humbuggery? Yes, Cox speaks of the market as God, the traditional God who is omnipotent, that is, all-powerful, omniscient, that means knows everything, and is everywhere, omnipresent. Cox makes a very good case that every single proclamation made about God in traditional theologies can now be made about the market. He was stunned when he first realized this, and as he has studied more, he knew he was really onto something. And since he published his article in the Atlantic Monthly, many have come to agree. I'm blown away by his theory myself. It makes a lot of sense. It's out there. You can read it, or you can read it online when you get home. Now, this is a religious movement too, Unitarian Universalism. And we actually have a principal theology of money too. Did you know that? We do. As we figure out our budget and plans for next year, as we do anything to help finance or create our visions and shape our visions for a safer and more just world, this theology is there. It's very clear, too. And it's not based on prosperity theology, giving to God, or a manipulative preacher, actually, to get something financially back. It's not based on shame, either, in any way. It's not based on the stark, austere, and mere practicality of this is what we need, so pay up. Our theology is clearly stated, however, in our very first principle, very clear. The one where we unashamedly claim and proclaim the inherent worth of every person. The inherent worth of every person. Worth has a financial edge to it, doesn't it? Cox says that it's been spoken sometimes throughout history. Actually, it's central to us. It's major. We speak it all the time. Inherent worth, not bought worth, not worth granted by the omnipotent market God, not debated worth. Let's have a debate. You get to marry each other, you don't. Let's debate this in public. Not worth granted by anyone or earned, inherent worth. You come with it. It's who you are. It cannot be taken away. Although, of course, people are going to try and convince you that they need to take it away. But there's no reason for you to yield your worth to anyone else, no matter how tricky they are. Your worth is yours. It's inherent in everyone else, too, everyone sitting beside you. And it is inherent and absolute in the homeless on the street corner, in the farm workers picking tomatoes, in people who have no work and haven't had work for 6 years, in immigrants newly arrived, in prisoners in our system, in the difficult, in those who believe, those who don't believe, those who doubt, those who struggle, those who reject, those who pray, those who bow, those who love the Sermon on the Mount, those who prefer Buddha's flower, and those who prefer H.L. Mencken's fury. It's inherent in all of them. This place is a home for me because the inherent worth of all people is the bottom line. And I'm not talking just about this particular congregation in Columbus. I'm talking about the whole religious movement of which this is a part. This is a home toward which I have been journeying with others all of my life. Even when I doubted that I was worth anything at all, and believe me, the length of times that that was true are long indeed. I was traveling here especially then, actually. I'm not here yet. None of us are. There is no final arrival. We're always journeying, always traveling toward that home, toward this direction. But this is a place where I don't have to let the glaring noise of the society around me, the market god, drown out the song of the tiniest cricket. I can hear it if I attend to it, if I pay attention. This is a place where I don't have to become so completely insensitive that I don't flinch when the whole world touches me, to get back to Nye's poem. I can actually sometimes retain some of my sensitivity and say, too much, stop. Here I can draw limits. I can engage in comfort, not competition, all the while welcoming the joys of cooperation while I journey together with you. Now, I don't know about you, but I personally do not always understand financial jargon. And sometimes I feel embarrassed by that. That's where shame sometimes seeps into me, and I have to push it aside consciously in order to keep on going forward in my journey. People talk about these words as if everyone knows what they are, or they're self-defining. They're not. Maybe someday we could even offer some classes in this church on financial understanding, so others who are confused and silenced by the market god can at least understand what's necessary to resist being completely taken in by the unconsciousness of it all. I learned at a meeting in California last week that younger generations than my own have other patterns of how they look at money. Many, for instance, don't carry cash at all. So that something so simple as the ritual of the offering may have no meaning one day. Me, I'm going to continue to pledge as I have 5% of my income toward this spiritual home of mine. But someday we may have to address things in a very different way because things are different. The generations rise and fall. Everything changes. It's the way it is. To pretend otherwise is a waste of time. Step by step, however, we'll figure it out. Together. I can't do it by myself any more than Debbie can do it by herself. I've talked to my colleagues and I've learned that every other UU congregation is facing the same issues as we face. So we're not alone, never have been. But once again, we are journeying toward a home for our spirit with everything that we do here. And by everything we offer here. Home. And I assure you, I'll repeat this again. When I was driving home from Cleveland on Wednesday morning by that time, and passed sign after sign on the highway leading me closer and closer, it was the word home itself and all that it means that was enough to keep me going and that restored my energy even in my weariness. It kept the noise of the world out of my heart and gave me focus and direction. Step after step, each step enough and more than enough. But altogether, it brought me home. Let's go.